Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. We love that you do that. We really appreciate it. On this week's podcast, the brilliant Mary Roach is back on the programme. Every time I talk to her, I feel giddy because the way she communicates science and the stories that she tells and the nonsense she gets up to in her books. It's always a great laugh, so stay with us for that. We'll also get to some of your comments later on in the podcast. You can email us at science@newstalk.com if you want to comment on this one. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us in studio is Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield of the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Jessamine, our first story... funny mood today. Our first story, Jessamine, is a rather surprisingly sad one because I have been lucky enough to go to France and Switzerland every once in a while to go skiing. I've been very lucky to do that, right? It's a real privilege. And there, if you ski Chamonix, the Glace de Mer, which is this amazing glacier, you can ski all the way down. It's a big, long thing. Right off a precipice at some point. And if you're a good skier, I highly recommend you do it. But when you get down to the bottom, you have to climb up all these steps to get to the top. And as you go up, you see the ice level per year. And it is... they should just take that out because it is absolutely the most depressing thing in the world. You just see year after year, the ice level going down, 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 down. The last 15 years has been absolutely traumatic. What is this story about?
Well, this is about losing more ice off of those glaciers, specifically in Switzerland. And I think, you know, even here, we're very aware that like this was quite a warm summer, right? And the winter last year was quite warm as well and a bit less precipitation than we'd normally see. And that was true in Switzerland. And researchers at ETH Zurich have just released results showing that actually in the year 2025 so far, there's been the fourth greatest loss ever in glaciers in Switzerland after 2022, 2023 and 2003. So obviously... the 2020s not off to a good start for the beautiful glaciers of Switzerland. And it's, as you say, it's really stark when you can actually see it in person. I mean, even on these really huge glaciers, we're seeing big losses in both the thickness of the ice and in their extent into these kind of valleys, like you're describing at Chamonix. But there's also over 1,000 small glaciers that have just vanished, totally melted away. And, you know, you might think, okay, well, this is just another chapter in horrible things that climate change is doing to our planet. But actually, one thing that glaciers do for the mountains that they are found in is they help to stabilize them, you know, both directly by supporting the mountainside just in a structural, mechanical way. But also often the glaciers are protecting permafrost along the sides of the mountains and close to the top from being exposed to heat and sun and melting. So losing these glaciers off of the side of mountains very much contributes to those mountains being less and less stable. And, you know, we saw a prime example of that earlier this year in Switzerland when that huge avalanche buried an entire village, the village of Blatten in the Luttenschall Valley in Switzerland back in May. Mm. Those kind of massive avalanches are becoming more and more likely, which of course has a huge impact on the people that live in these mountains. And it really goes to show, you know, glaciers aren't just beautiful. They're also really important in the landscapes in which we find them. And unfortunately, the hotter that the world gets, the more these glaciers are starting to go away.
Yeah. When we talk about glacier ice, is that all the ice on top of a mountain range, or is there glacier ice and then something underneath the glacier ice, like a different type of sheet ice or something, or how does it work?
Yeah, so I mean, there's seasonal snow and ice, obviously, that we see in pretty much all mountain ranges. And then you get glaciers where you get this accumulation of snow and ice that then starts to kind of compress in on itself. So it's quite cool if you've ever gotten the chance to see like into the bottom of a glacier, like the ice gets very, very blue and very clear because basically all of the air has been compressed out of it. It's really unbelievable. I think glaciers are incredibly beautiful as well as their like utility to us and to the landscape. But they're also a real bellwether for climate change because you can just see the way that they are falling away at their interfaces, like at the face of a glacier, what's called calving, where big things break off or melt away. You know, in the sea, this would lead to things like icebergs and ice in the water. Mm. But on land, we end up seeing these glacial lakes, which you see a lot of in Switzerland, that would have, they often look quite cloudy because they've got a lot of silt mixed into them. But yeah, they have this very important structural role in the mountains, right, as well as being beautiful and interesting to look at. And I mean, it's just another reason why we need to protect these environments and the world as a whole.
Yeah, I was going to say, and the good news is we can do something about it, but that isn't even funny.
I mean, we can do something about it, well, and perhaps we should.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. Laura, our second story has to do with junk food. I think this is a really interesting one.
Yeah, it really is. It really talks about how fast food or junk food really impacts your brain and not just your waistline, right? So there's been some, for many years, we've known that metabolic disorders like obesity and type 2 diabetes really has a strong association with cognitive ability, right? But it hasn't really been looked at what part of your brain and what cellular level does your diet and your high-fat diet have an impact. And this is what this study did, is they actually looked at cellular mechanisms in your brain and how that really had an impact on your hippocampus, which is the part of your brain for your memory and trying to, you know, navigate where you're going. And they actually showed different cells in that were actually impacted by a high-fat diet. So it's kind of very interesting to really connect, you know, the food that you eat really does have a direct impact on your brain and your memory.
So what sort of effect did they have and how do they measure that?
Yeah, great. So when I say your brain, I mean, you know, as all these things go, they actually tested with mice first, okay? So they actually had three groups of mice and they gave one group of mice normal food, one group of mice a high-fat diet, but the same calorie intake, which is really important. And then they gave another one with a high-fat diet, but also a bit of sugar. And what they found is when they tested their cognitive abilities, their memory, these novel place recognition, and they have two objects, and then they move one object a little while later, and the mice that had their normal diet went and looked at the object that moved. And the mice that had this high-fat diet didn't really know what was going on, just kind of equally looked at them both. So they said the mice with this high-fat diet really weren't able to remember the room they were in before and where these objects were. And it really just showed that their memory was significantly impacted by their diet. And what was interesting was not just their diet over long term, and then they became three fat mice, right? They really were, it was in a period of 4 days on this diet, they really had severe cognitive impacts.
I thought you were going to say this was about ultra-processed food, which of course is getting a lot of attention for similar-ish reasons. But this is just sugar and fat. So this is, you know, this isn't necessarily ultra-processed. This is just high-sugar, high-fat foods, which I love.
Exactly, we all do. So this was interesting. It's really thinking about the composition and kind of how much the carbohydrates versus fat versus sugar that you eat.
Right.
And interestingly, it wasn't that it was fat and sugar that was the issue. It was a high fat specifically. And what it actually did was this high fat diet impacted these things called CCK interneurons, right? But what you really need to think about of them are a special type of regulator cell which goes into your brain's memory hub and kind of controls how you make memories.
Right.
And these are kind of inhibited by sugar. So what the high-fat diet was not allowing the right amount of glucose, which is sugar, to go to these cells to act normally, and they kind of went a bit haywire.
Huh.
So it was interesting. This third group of mice that I mentioned, they had this high-fat diet with a bit of sugar, and they actually were okay. So it's really about, you know, thinking about what you eat and the composition of the food that you eat to really get that balance of what your brain needs looking forward. And a final thing is that it's reversible. So the mice that forgot where they were, once they kind of brought them back to a normal diet or they inhibited some of these crazy interneurons with some drugs, they got their memory back. So a bit of good news in the end of the story, but just really interested in what you are, what you eat, and you really need to think about what we're eating, which is unfortunate because we all love high-fat things.
Yeah, for sure. One of my favorite things to eat is those flips. Have you ever had those flips pretzels?
Ooh,
they're like pretzels covered in chocolate.
Tell me more.
Like high salt, high chocolate, and then just like, you know, pretzel. Oh, it's so good.
Do you lose your keys afterwards, maybe?
I lose my mind. Yeah. Jessamine, our third story has to do with chlamydia, which apparently is a big problem for koalas.
Yes, you might not have known this, but 50% of all the koalas living in Australia have chlamydia. We don't know why. Look, so chlamydia, as we know, it's a sexually transmitted infection that's caused by a bacterium. So it's a horrible disease. It causes blindness, infections, infertility. And we all love koalas. We don't want that to happen to them. And especially now, you know, that there's smaller populations of koalas in general, it kind of makes it that much worse when chlamydia like tears through a community. Mm. And it's actually, weirdly, in koalas, chlamydia is uniquely hard to treat with antibiotics, right? Which is what you would normally use to treat a bacterial infection, because it turns out that koalas are very good at like neutralizing drugs. So they need incredibly high doses of antibiotics compared to humans. And it's kind of just like putting a plaster over a wound, right? It's not treating the cause anyway. So researchers at the University of the Sunshine Coast, which I have to say is one of the best university names I've ever encountered. Yeah. They have developed this vaccine, which basically the way that it works is it targets a protein on the outside of the bacterium, and it targets it with multiple drugs that work both inside and outside of cells, which is a thing that makes making a vaccine for chlamydia challenging. It works with a single dose, which is really good, given that to vaccinate a koala, you first have to catch it.
Yeah.
And they've released the results of basically this first decade of clinical data that shows lower rates of chlamydia for the vaccinated koalas, lower disease-related mortality. And basically now it's been approved in Australia for use over the next 2 years in wildlife hospitals. So it's really exciting if you like koalas. The researchers did point out that this vaccine needs to be implemented alongside other conservation measures like preserving habitat, because obviously there is more to life than just not having chlamydia. But, you know, it's an important start.
Social stigma of chlamydia? Does that also exist in koala populations?
You know, that's a great question that I'm not sure if these researchers addressed. I don't know how
more research
aware
required
koalas
sounds
are.
Like. Very
yeah,
good.
That's more of a social science study for the social science of koalas. But that's, you know, maybe that's follow up work that we can look at.
Laura, our final study has to do with our sleep.
Yeah, it's kind of a study that's really you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? So this study looked at whether your long commute or the house of your size, or the size of your house, is wrecking your sleep. And the answer is kind of both, right? So this is a study done in Japan by Osaka Metropolitan University, where they looked in September last year and they did a survey of people working in the Tokyo metropolitan area. And they did a survey of people's insomnia and sleepiness and how long their commute was and what the size of their house is. And this is kind of tied to, you would assume, you know, further out of the city you have a bigger house and you go into the city of a smaller house. And basically they found that, you know, over half the participants suffered with insomnia or signs of insomnia and sleepiness if they had their commute of larger than 50 minutes.
Right.
And if your house is smaller than 95 square meters per four people, which is actually quite large, right? 95 square meters of a house isn't too small. This also had a dramatic impact on your sleepiness. So if you want to live close to the city and not have a commute, you're impacted by your sleep by having a small apartment. If you live further out and you have a long commute, you're also impacted with your sleep.
I mean, the smaller house, you might have people making noises all the time. We went away for the weekend to Accol to the amazing Battle for the Lake festival. And there was a guy staying with us and he stayed in the shed. There was beds all over the house. He was not allowed in the house. This is a big house with solid walls. He's not allowed. He snores so much that you cannot stay in the same room as him. He was in a shed in a tent.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I can get with that, but a commute, I don't understand why a commute would make you more likely to have insomnia. Do they have any ideas?
Yeah, so I guess I should say that. So this study really looked at people commuting either by public transport or by walking, right? So most of the people that were kind of going over 50 minutes were on public transport and they had to be in by 9 a.m. So it's not necessarily that, you know, you're commuting and that's it. It's an association. So you're maybe stressed. You're on the commute. You're in a packed train and you're going very long distances.
Right.
It's 2 hours of your day. It's 50 minutes, you know, that you're standing and you're maybe not exercising or you're stressed. So this is the kind of association.
And there could be particulate matter in the air. There's lots of different things. But essentially, the lesson from this is, folks, have a big house or live close to where you work.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing is they said they looked at people who actually made more money and they also had less insomnia. So just have a big house with a short commute and have loads of money and you can sleep well.
You're welcome, everybody. Your problem solved again next week in the news round. Laura Hayes and Jessamine Fairfield, thank you very much. Yes, this is Future Brief on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us science@newstalk.com. Can your body be rebuilt like a car? Could you swap out your organs like spare parts or even build a new penis from your finger? We're going to be diving into the world of regenerative medicine with the best-selling science author Mary Roach, whose latest book, Replaceable You, explores this very subject. Mary, it's great to have you on the programme. Always enjoy the capers you get up to researching your books. They're half as interesting as the studies themselves or what you end up doing as a result of them. So let's just get straight into it. What's the book about and what did you get up to?
Well, it's really what you were just talking about, just replacing bits and pieces of the human form. So whether you're growing them from scratch or swapping them out or building them or printing them, or back in the day, the various things that were people were trying to do before we had the technologies that we have. So just kind of a grand and all over the map kind of Mary Roach approach to
madness.
I would say regenerative medicine, but that makes it sound really, really complicated and off-putting. So I don't use that term, but you know, you could use that term because I do step into stem cells and bioprinting in my own kind of wingnut way.
Okay, so we talked a lot in this program about xenotransplantation, this idea that you can take the heart of an animal or the lung of an animal or any sort of body part, you know, strip it of its body partness,
yes,
and then give it to a human. And I wanted to know how far you got with this, because I imagine pretty far.
Yeah, I'm actually about 30% pig now. I'm not, no. No. I spent time at a super clean pigsty, essentially, in China, where these pigs, because I was fascinated by this notion of the juxtaposition of super clean with a pigsty. So these are very, 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 very clean pigs. There's this sense, I think, because there's been a lot of media coverage that, you know, it's right around the corner. In this country, we have, there's two firms, United Therapeutics and eGenesis, that are creating the pigs. As you mentioned, they're sort of being genetically edited so that they're less pig and more human. In other words, they're just removing a protein that really signals to the human body, hey, this is foreign, get it out of here. So then it precludes this, it's called a hyperacute rejection. If you were just to take a pig heart, say, straight out of a pig and install it in a human, you'd get this very vigorous rejection. It would start to turn black almost immediately, and it would just be, like, destroyed because it's so foreign. So the genetic edits take away one of the proteins that really triggers that. But you still need to have immunosuppression. And right now,
I kind of imagine them wearing, you know, little ties and hats and, like, you know, going to the water cooler. Like, I wasn't sure how human you made them, but that's, I mean, just gene editing, I guess that's okay. I guess that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And that, you know, the thing is, they're still pigs. You know, I went to this facility, I went all the way to China, and I'm like, I thought I'd be able to kind of get in and interact with the pigs, but you know, I'm a human. I'm like a walking pile of bacteria and fungi and whatever else is on me. So I was able to observe from the control room just outside, and they're like, here are the pigs, and these are, you know, this is the designated pathogen-free facility. It's super clean, and the food is irradiated, and the pigs are tested for 40 different viruses and bacteria. And I'm looking at the screen, it's like some pigs lolling around, some pig poo on the pee on the bottom of the, you know, you can't edit a pig to the point, yeah, where it uses a toilet. So it's still a pigsty.
Let's talk about the penis, because you know, it's obviously
because
the
why not
hook, the standout hook for the book, right? Penises are tricky to make, are they?
Yeah, a penis is like a face or a hand. It's what's known as a composite tissue allotransplant, like allo as in from somebody else. So you got all these different types of tissue going on. It's not as straightforward, say, as a kidney. It's got the skin. It's got the erectile chambers. There's, you know, there's muscle. There's, anyway, it's a tricky thing from an immune perspective. And so, yeah, I spent some time with tracking down a surgeon who has a kind of a very unorthodox approach. And I initially heard about it just from a researcher who didn't provide me a lot of details. She said he had used a man's own middle finger to create rebuild a penis. The patient had had cancer. And I, of course, because I'm me, pictured the finger removed intact with the nail still on it and installed in a way that it could bend and kind of beckon, which I thought would be, you know, hey, baby.
Come hither.
Yeah. And I found the paper. It was just an abstract in Russian. I wanted to talk to this man because it is an unorthodox approach.
There are sure
medical, you can, if you're, you know, there are implants that are, you know, made from either little inflatable deals or they're malleable, but they're made with, you know, non-reactive materials, and you can, you know, put them in the erectile chamber or use it to, you know, build just sort of for the rigidity. If you're using, say, skin on the forearm, you can rebuild. There's ways. What I'm saying is
there's are more than one ways to make a penis. You said if you wanted, you know, rigidity, are you saying that there are like different models that if you're getting a replacement penis, there's different models that are scientifically or medically available, that there's a rigid one and a non-rigid version? Is it like an adapter plug or do you have to constantly have an erection?
No. Last time I looked into this, which was several books back, this particular question that you're asking, there were two different.
To this question, I see.
Yes, I see. It always comes around to penises, doesn't it? With you and me, apparently. So, you can use what's called a malleable penile implant, and I have one on the shelf. I'd show you, but we're on radio. And it's a bendable thing that you put one in each erectile. There's these two chambers, erectile chambers. So if it's an erectile dysfunction patient, you'd put one in each, and you can bend. Now, you don't have Gumby over there, do you? That figure where you bend the limbs and they stay?
Oh, you know, my God. No, but I think Gumby. I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
So it's a kind of a Gumby thing where you would, you know, you could bend it up into the erection, or you could bend it flat. So you could, you know, put on your pants. Am I saying the undies? I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, so you went to Georgia.
the other kind is the inflatable kind, where there's a little pump in the scrotum that you screw in it, and it pumps up, and then you can deflate it after the act.
You went to Georgia
yes.
to see this man who remade the penis using a finger. How did it work out? Because it feels it feels like a penis and a finger are quite different appendages.
Yeah. And I should point out, this is the country of Georgia, not the state of Georgia. I went all the way there because this is kind of my approach. If someone doesn't respond to my, and I wrote in, you know, Georgian and Russian and English, no reply. So I just showed up. And he was on vacation, the surgeon, but the office manager was lovely. And she said, well, we can go into his office and I can open up his computer and show you images. So she did that. And of course the finger was the interior. It was sort of the strength and backbone, if you will, of this penis. And then it was, they took skin from, I think the underside of the forearm is usually used because it's hairless, although this one did have some hair. And that sort of wrapped around, and then it's in the way that plastic surgeons do, they create the glands and the other, you know, the things that the hallmark look of a penis. And it did look like a penis, but it had a finger inside. And here's the thing, the finger, while it's not hooked up such that the man could, you know, the way bend his finger the way you bend your finger. It was bendable. And halfway along, she showed me a photograph with it bent up, like, so it kind of looks like a hook. And then in the next photograph, and I'm not sure, this was, I guess, to show how strong it was holding a ceramic water pitcher. It's like white with kind of a green and red.
Mary Roach, the things you have seen. So, let's talk about something else, because I know you've done. What else did you get up to over there? Like, what sort of stories have you got for us?
Well, I wanted to spend a night in an old polio era iron lung.
What is that?
An iron lung, it's a breathing device where the person, it kind of looks like a hot water heater on its side, or maybe a very low-tech MRI tube. So this bed rolls out, you would install the patient on the bed, roll it back in, and then pull the head through this little aperture and then tighten it around the neck. So the only thing outside is the head, the breathing part of the, you know, the person is outside breathing and the rest of the body is inside. So it works by a change in pressure. So, which is kind of how we, you know, when you use your muscles to expand your rib cage and you know, diaphragm is all involved in opening it up, which draws in the air because of the change in pressure. So it's a very sort of gentle way of breathing as opposed to the kind of ventilators in an ICU unit, intensive care unit, which are kind of like a medical leaf blower, just blowing down, you know, inflating your lung like you would inflate a balloon.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know, because the tube is going through.
Just walk me through the looks of it. So you're kind of in what sounds like a sleeping bag wrapped around. And then do you have tubes coming out of your mouth?
Oh, no. That's what's great about an iron lung. See, with the kind that's in the intensive care unit, you have the tube coming down through the vocal cords. You can't speak, you can't eat, you're often sedated. But the iron lung, you can eat, you can talk, you don't have any tubes going through you. It's a very natural way of breathing. The downside, of course, is that you're in a large metal tube. But what's really interesting about the iron lung is that when you read memoirs of people who had paralytic polio who you know, very quickly over the course of days couldn't breathe and were like struggling to breathe, and they took them to these, they called them tank farms, where there was row after row during these epidemics of iron lungs, and they were installed in there, and that like they would describe it as this kind of euphoria that they could finally breathe, they could relax, they could sleep. Anyway, so I was like, how could that be euphoric? I don't know. So I thought I should try it. So I did find somebody who had an old 1950s iron lung that his wife had used. And
that's something you want to keep around.
That is, yeah, it's a large thing to keep around the house.
For sure.
But you never know when some wingnut writer is going to call you up and say, hey, can I come spend the night in your iron lung?
And you were okay? You were obviously alive.
Yeah, I was okay. You know, it was set on high, like the highest level, which I didn't realize. So I was like, like that. And you start
to
get
that. Night?
No, you know what? I lasted, I think, 7 minutes. Oh,
well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. So, wouldn't want you to suffer too much for your heart. every time I read one of Mary's books, I find myself laughing out loud. I can't recommend them enough. This latest book is called Replaceable You. Mary, thank you so much. And look after yourself, won't you?
I will. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking to Professor Oren Sherman from Cambridge about the creation of artificial smart cartilage, which I thought was so awesome. What are the potential side effects and risks of using this material in joints long term? Well, it's pretty new. We don't yet know, but because these are hydrogels, soft and built for the places they're made, much less than the typical approach. Kelly Morrison is professor of experimental physics at Loughborough. She was talking about making the world's smallest violin using teeny tiny laser beams. Rose says, now I want to know what other small structures are out there that could challenge the scale of the world's smallest violin and how teeny they are. Well, look at that. We've inspired somebody to learn about more science. God. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan. Thanks to Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva, Scott on sound. Thank you for listening and being here with us during this special time. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.